Welcome to Real GM Radio. I am Daniel Rue, your host, and so happy to have you with us for this episode. Apologies for the delay, but this is my episode with Stefan Noe, now of the Sporting News. I'm super excited about that. And we focus primarily on the Chicago Bulls and their success this year. The delay makes it so to play this places and timing. We knew some of the injuries, but we didn't know the severity. But I don't think that really affects the analysis much. I think that what Stefan provides in terms of how the Bulls have been successful, that all of that really fits together super well. And we also talk about his really fun Hidden Gem series, where he's talking about some of the less appreciated players in the NBA. And really fun conversation, runs a little bit under an hour. I hope you enjoy it. Thank you so much for coming on.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Danny.
I'd been wanting to do a Bulls podcast for a while and realized that you would be a great person to talk to. There are, of course, a lot of people who know this team well, but I think you do really good work on the substantive side and also just kind of thinking about this team in the big picture. And I think the place to start for me is I thought I was much more skeptical of what this team could be, though the focus of that was more as a playoff team than as a regular season team. But they really have exceeded expectations on both ends of the floor. I mean, at this point, especially on offense, as we're recording this, they're fourth. What do you think has... What has exceeded your expectations, and what do you think is driving this season for them?
Well, I mean, I was pretty high on the Bulls to start the year. I had them at, I think, 47 wins. But, I mean, they're on pace for more than that. They've, even like the biggest optimists, they've done better than what those people expect. So I think that, I mean, a lot of it has just been driven by DeMar being insane, right? And like nobody could have predicted that I think he's pretty solidly been like a top 10 player, probably even you could say like top six, I think.
He's been phenomenal.
Yeah, he's dropped off a little bit recently, although he just had an incredible game against the Cavs last night where every single time he saw Lauri Markkanen, I think he was trying to score. And that worked pretty well for him. Yeah, but I think that there was bound to be like a little bit of regression for him, and that's started to happen. But even with that baked in regression, they've just gotten such great performances from, I mean, they have like 16 new players on this team. So all of their new additions, I think those guys playing in different scenarios than they had been used previously, that's just unlocked the best part of their games. And that's been something that has been kind of a thing for a lot of these Billy Donovan coach teams. I think he does a great job of empowering his players and using them in very creative ways. So a lot of the credit has to go to Donovan.
I agree. And I had been skeptical. Matt Moore and I had this discussion before the season started about whether he could cobble together a credible defense. And there are two things that I think went into play there. One, like they've been more versatile, interestingly, than I expected, and they've been able to do it. But the bigger part, there are a bunch of different parallels that are worth thinking about here. One of them that I've made before is the Russell Westbrook Thunder teams when he won the MVP, which is when you can rely on two or potentially three players to do your heavy lifting offensively, you can get away, assuming they can do the things offensively that you need, you can get away with more defensive-oriented players at the other spots. And I think that general structure has worked very well for Chicago this season.
I think you're absolutely right there. And yeah, you bring it back to Oklahoma City. Donovan had so many one-way players, just defensive stalwarts on those teams, like Andre Roberson is the big one, you know, and later on, Lou Dort, he's a little bit better offensively. But just these lockdown defender guys, I think that there's been some talk about how DeMar has gotten better on defense. Maybe that's true to a little bit, but I think he's still pretty solidly below average on that end.
I agree.
The way the Bulls have gotten around that is, you know, they have Javonte Green starting most of the year at four, which that's another example of what I was talking about with Billy Donovan using these guys very creatively. I mean, Javonte Green is like 6'4". He's been shooting guard, small forward most of his career. So to move him up in that position, I think that was, you know, definitely a very good move from Donovan. And then obviously, you know, Ball and Caruso have been the other big driving forces behind this defense. And they've also gotten really good unexpected on-ball defense from Ayo Dosunmu, which, again, nobody saw that coming. And I think that's another testament to Donovan, where he had a lot of confidence and faith in Dosunmu, where I think most coaches would not play a guy in his rookie year that much to that extent, where he's usually guarding like the best perimeter defenders or perimeter players now. So Yeah, that, like you said, just having those good defensive players to surround some of the weaker pieces, I think has been the secret sauce to the Bulls' success. Well, I mean, earlier on in the season, lately they've been slipping a little bit because they've been missing some of those players, but that's I think that's how they were exceeding expectations early on.
Right, and I like that you brought up empowering players, because that is another important part of the story of this Bulls team, is that while there are, especially when absences come in volume, there are things that you can't quite overcome, especially when, like, at this point when it's LaVine and Lonzo out at the same time, because they occupy two roles that you can replace but you can't fully replace, and so you get into those, and that's the nature of an 82 game regular season, is that there are going to be those stretches of time. But the functional depth of this Bulls team has been much better than I anticipated, and Dosunmu is a fantastic example of that. As we're recording this, 63% true shooting, and to me, as you said, defense is the story, but for a defensive player to be hitting enough threes, you know, he's at 70 attempts overall on the season in 800 minutes, but doing that and then making 60% of his twos, you know, driving hard, getting those shots, also making his mid-rangers, that might tone down a little bit. But to be able to, again, that OKC duality of defensive player does enough offensively that the other team has to take him seriously. And the other thread there, which I think the Bulls have done a great job handling, and I don't know how you portion the credit between the players individually, Donovan, the coaching staff, and I mean, we don't have to necessarily, is Nate uses the term like an advantage, like creating an advantage. And one of the elements that those other players have to do is they don't necessarily have to create that many advantages. That's on DeRozan, that's on Zach LaVine, and, you know, just generally pushing the ball hard in transition. However, you can, those are kind of like three big ways that the Bulls do it. But what is on the other players is when you have an advantage, when the ball comes to you and that advantage exists, make the most of it. Sometimes that's taking an open three. Sometimes that's driving to the basket and finishing. Sometimes that's making a couple dribbles and a good decision. And I think the Bulls have done a far better job than most of maximizing those opportunities, whether they were the best players offensively or other players on the roster.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think that speaks to the management that this team has. Like, they really had a vision of how they wanted to play. And this is, again, why they've been overachieving this year, is because the roles that they place these guys in just really makes them look like the best version of themselves possible. And the two biggest examples of that, I think, are Ball and Caruso. Like, those are two guys who, especially like Lonzo in New Orleans, like when he's tasked too much with just being the primary creator, like, I don't think he's great at generating an advantage. But like you said, they have these second side pick and roll guys where they swing the ball, they get the defense shifted already, and they can really take advantage of that. Another guy who I think is a good example of that is Kobe White. Like, Kobe struggled a lot in his first couple years because he was tasked as being kind of like the traditional point guard role, and it's not something that he's necessarily great at, but he's had a much better couple of months just because he's learned to play off the advantages that especially DeRozan is creating for him. And I think he is really good at, you know, he's one of the fastest guys in the league. So when he has that initial advantage already created for him, he knows how to capitalize. And he's also has like a lightning quick release. So anytime he has some space, he can get that shot off. So yeah, it's just a testament to, I think it's interesting. Like, you look at a team like the Lakers that's struggling so much, and there was just very little regard given for roster construction in that situation. They just wanted to accrue like the most high end talent possible. And then you look at a team like the Bulls where, yeah, every piece was acquired with the thought process of how they fit with the other pieces, and it just worked out beautifully for the Bulls.
I like the juxtaposition with the Lakers, especially because one of the key decisions for both off-seasons involved the same human being, and that's Alex Caruso, where Alex Caruso occupied a largely similar role, and correct me if you disagree, with the Lakers and the Bulls. The Lakers didn't necessarily value that. I think they thought his skill set was more replaceable. The Bulls saw how that could fit with LaVine and DeMar DeRozan in particular, and it's working out far better for the Bulls to have him than for the Lakers to have let him go. And there is a challenge, big picture, with having too many players that aren't scalable in terms of responsibility, because basically what that means is that the other players typically have to be there, though the Bulls have won some nice games when they've been a little bit shorthanded this year. However, it's also way easier and way more practical to find those players and put them in a place to succeed and then hope that you can find, you know, DeMar DeRozan's don't always become available, but the Bulls did a great job. They paid a lot to get him, not only in terms of salary, but in terms of trade equity, let's put it that way, to do it. But as you said, the front office deserves a lot of credit, and especially credit from me because I disagreed with them, that their theory of the case is bearing out.
I like that law school reference. Yeah. The theory of the case is indeed bearing out. And I mean, I was a DeMar skeptic too, a little bit, probably not to the extent that a lot of people were. But yeah, I mean, I think it just shows great foresight. And, you know, with the Caruso thing, I understand why the Lakers might have been okay with letting him go, because there are a lot of these defensive specialists that you see are very easily replaceable. Like I'm thinking of, like a Shaq Harrison type. But the difference, what separates Caruso from those guys, I think, first of all, like, he's just better. I mean, I think he's top three on-ball defender at his position. And the Bulls have used him basically on everybody. Like, he's guarded big guys, he's guarded speedy guards, and he's done a good job on all those guys. And then the other thing is just, like, the intangibles that he brings. I mean, it sounds very cliche, but the Bulls just got him back last night against the Cavs, and they ended this four-game losing streak. And DeMar DeRozan had this quote after the game that Caruso basically sounds like, I'm going to mess up the wording, but it's something like he sounds like a college professor reading out his thesis or something. And there have been so many examples of his communication on the court. Like, Caruso's basically the quarterback of the Bulls defense. You could see last night for the first time in a very, very long time that their rotations on the backside of their defense were way better than they have been. And that was the case in the beginning of the season when he went out. The Bulls are a team that brings help early, and they depend on those rotations in order to stop teams, and they're falling apart. And then, you know, as soon as he comes back in, like, they're back good again. So I think that really speaks to the value that, maybe it's not captured very well in regards to, you know, other defensive specialists. He might look the same on paper, but there's just so much more stuff that he's doing out there.
The combination of being a capable individual defender and a capable team defender is actually pretty hard to find in a guard. And that's something that makes Caruso special. Now, there have been times where he can be a little bit overzealous as a team defender, but generally speaking, Caruso plays with the intensity and has the physical, like, skills to make up for that. You know, he helps far often than he is burned by that help. And I think that is a very good place to be. And as you mentioned, that defensive versatility is central, because you need your best defenders to do a lot of different things when you have a couple guys that you don't want to put in those assignments. And the story, kind of in some ways, with DeRozan is it's a reciprocal, but it also ties in with those other limited offensive players defensively, is that DeRozan is an extremely limited defensive player. He, you know, can give up drives, and doesn't always function in the team capacity, or he's not the greatest transition defender. But especially in the regular season, if you give him modest things to do, he can do them. He has been a part of successful defenses before. I mean, San Antonio was a decent example of that, and Toronto, of course, had some when he was there too. And so while he wasn't the reason those teams were great, he can be a part of it if you don't need him to do a lot. And I think that having Caruso, having Javonte Green and Derek Jones Jr., and in an ideal world, Patrick Williams, and I want to come back to him, that puts him in a situation to succeed. So like the other guys, it's natural to focus on the weaknesses, on the shortcomings, because those matter a lot when it comes down to it. But they're correctable, adjustable shortcomings, at least in the regular season.
Yeah, I think the Bulls players do have a lot of flaws, like serious flaws, and I think that's why the Bulls were able to get these guys. But like I said before, Donovan is just so good at hiding them by playing guys together whose strengths mask the other person's flaws, right? So I am kind of curious to see what happens in the playoffs, because, you know, teams are preparing a lot more to try to exploit those flaws. But I don't know. I mean, I think that it's just worked so well in the regular season when the team has been healthy that I'm definitely higher on the Bulls, like, as a playoff team than I think most people are. So yeah, we're just gonna have to wait and see. That's gonna be one of the biggest questions in the playoffs, the NBA playoffs, for me.
It is, and I'm taking largely a wait and see approach to it, because I often think of the construction of, like, the dominant individual players and the, you know, those undeniable guys. And there are definitely a portion of those in the Eastern Conference with Giannis and with Kevin Durant and Joel Embiid, and we'll see what the Heat are kind of undeniable as a team defense, which is a little bit different. But I don't know right now, and a lot of this will depend on availability and anything else, if there is that monolith, that behemoth in the conference that gives the Bulls so many problems that they're unsolvable, you know, like that level of team. And the Bucks are, all these teams are really good, but there's kind of a line many years between the, you know, like the absolute, like those teams that are truly challenging and maybe you can't solve it. And that's good news for the Bulls. I think that the idea that they can do it, there will be some challenging matchups, and I'm excited to see how it goes, because if it works out well, if I'm wrong, then that's great, because that means the team is exceeding expectations and is significantly more dangerous, and that's great. That's great for the league. It's great for everything.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think the league is wide open this year, and obviously, like, COVID is a big part of that too. So I think, like, the underdogs have certainly a better chance this year. Like, the Bulls haven't played the Bucks yet. That's going to be the big question. Against the Nets, they got totally destroyed on national TV.
They did,
but they are 2-1. So there's some promise there. They did struggle against the Sixers. I think, like, with Embiid's size in particular, they lost both of the games they've played against them. And then the Heat, I think one of those games you have to totally throw out because the Bulls had nobody. They were like playing their number 7 through 12 players. And then the other game was a very closely contested loss. So, yeah, I think the Bulls have shown so far, at least, that, you know, they can hang with the teams in the East, with the caveat that we haven't seen them against the Bucks. And, you know, they're obviously, they've been heavily rumored. I don't know, like, how well sourced these rumors are, but been heavily rumored in this Jeremy Grant sweepstakes. They have a lot of connections to him. I mean, Zach LaVine played with him on Team USA. Billy Donovan coached him in Oklahoma City. His uncle, Horace, works for the Bulls. And then AK had some overlap with him in Denver. So that certainly makes sense from a lot of different standpoints. And I think that he could definitely help them because, yeah, power forward with Patrick Williams out, that's kind of like their weakest spot, the lowest hanging fruit to improve. So, yeah, the Bulls may not be done here with their roster, and that would certainly help them compete against these big boys more.
It's such a fascinating question for this front office of, okay, you've already committed, you know, significant resources in the Vooch trade and in the DeRozan trade, but you still have assets available. Do you push harder for Jeremy Grant or for maybe Harrison Barnes, depending on how things go with the Kings? And the asking prices for those two will be such a big question, you know, like where is that? Because I think Barnes would actually be a really good fit with them. Grant is a better fit defensively because he's more defensively versatile, but Barnes could do, you know, he'd be interesting too. And so how much are those teams asking? What are other teams willing to pay for them? And a central figure in that you know well, and it's such a weird open question, is Patrick Williams. Patrick Williams played a lot as a rookie and was only able to play in 5 games this year before he went down, and he's out for roughly the rest of the year. We don't have an exact timeline. We know that the Bulls' application for disabled player exception was denied. But how do you see Patrick Williams fitting in, and how do you see his potential relative to him being the centerpiece of a trade for an immediate upgrade?
Well, I think anybody that tells you how Patrick Williams is going to develop just has no idea what they're talking about.
Totally, like, fair.
last year, his rookie year, he was the youngest player in the league outside of Poku. So obviously, like, he still has so much more development to do. We have no idea. And then he barely played this year. So can't really take much from that sample. You know, the Bulls saw something in him. They reached, I don't think many people had him as the number 4 pick in that draft. So obviously they really, really like something about him. I think that there might be some endowment effect going on there where they want to prove people right, you know, like,
for sure.
I think it would take a lot for them to move off of him because he hasn't really been given a full shot yet to show if they were right or not in making this very bold move at the time. Yeah, I mean, as far as my personal opinion on him, I don't think he had a great rookie year. I don't think it was terrible either. He showed some really nice flashes. He had, he had some crazy plays. He had one against DeAndre Ayton where he just ripped a lob away. That was actually, like, very similar to the one that Giannis had that went viral in the finals. So Patrick Williams did it first. I'll put that out there. But yeah, just not the consistency, which of course is normal for a player of that age.
Patrick Williams' rookie year was his age 19 season.
Yeah. He was a very, very young rookie. So we just don't know.
I'm especially intrigued by the Williams thought process because front offices, especially for players that they drafted, have to balance wanting to make the best team possible in the present versus trying to make the best team possible moving forward and everything else. And so I've said before that there isn't a right or wrong answer to this. It's just that you have to know what's important for you organizationally. And I think that's the case for the Bulls because DeMar DeRozan, this is his age 32 season, Vooch, age 31. And the other guys are younger, LaVine, 26, Ball, 24. Their brightest days are soon, maybe a little later, depending on how their skill development goes. The age curve can be complicated sometimes in around 26. But there is one idea, which is, okay, you maximize your chances for right now, so that might be Jeremy Grant, so throw your chips in. These next 2 years are probably going to be DeRozan's best 2 years. He's never played better than he's playing right now, and so you maximize it. But then the other part is, well, if your title equity is not either less important or you want to be consistently relevant, or you think Patrick Williams could end up being significantly better than Jeremy Grant, maybe he becomes a top 10 player at his position in a way that Grant probably is not at the moment as good as he is and wings are hard to find and everything else, then you think about it differently. And the Warriors are dealing with this as well with Kuminga and Wiseman and Moody, and the endowment effect is there too because they drafted two of those three guys pretty high, and at least one of them, there's the whole LaMelo Wiseman thing. And so it's not a definitive yes or no in the immediate. Presumably with hindsight, we will ascertain which way it went. And part of the challenge of that is these intriguing young players. How do you square the universe of potential outcomes? So the best case scenarios for Patrick Williams are very high. He's a physically talented guy. He has a lot of defensive potential. And especially after the growth of Kawhi Leonard and Jalen Brown, you're like, oh, these physically toolsy wings that have a little bit of ball skills, like we can make them into a dominant enough offensive player. But there is also a distinct chance that Williams is never as good as Barnes and as Jeremy Grant are now. And that is a risk premium that matters a lot for the arc of the franchise, even though it's hard to ascertain at any given point in time.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, I'm pretty aggressive on shopping him just because, like you said, I don't think DeMar is going to play this well for very much longer, right? I mean, you really have to take advantage of this window because if you want to win in the NBA, I mean, it's been pretty well proven that you need a top 10 player. And yes, Patrick Williams could become a top 10 player, but I think the chances of that are pretty low. Even like the best rookies in this class, like for them to be a top 10, that's just a very, very high bar to clear.
Sure.
Like we said before, I mean, the league is so wide open this year, especially in the Eastern Conference. I think that it just makes a ton of sense to just go for it now. And the analogy that I would give is like the George Hill for Kawhi trade. I mean, I definitely don't think that Patrick Williams, he gets compared to Kawhi a lot. I mean, I don't think he's going to ever reach that level. That's like kind of absurd where he's like top three player in the league.
Very few people do.
Yeah. I mean, I still think he could be very, very good, but maybe like a poor man's version of that trade where George Hill helped the Spurs that year, but obviously like if they could go back, he helped the Pacers that year, but if they could go back in time, they'd way, way rather have Kawhi, right? And like every subsequent year, that trade looked like more and more of a loss until you could pretty definitively say, a couple years out that, yeah, Kawhi is by far the better player. But I think the Bulls could be at risk of falling victim to that. But the Pacers needed to win at that time. I think the Bulls need to win at this time. So I think you could definitely justify it. And you just have to live with what happens with Patrick Williams in the future.
The other big consideration that I would advise the Bulls front office on here, and I hadn't really thought about this fully until you kind of started me down this train, is the Bulls' entire structure is built around these two dynamic creators. And they have a lot of good players. They have a lot of good players that are either, let's say, under contract or we expect to be under contract. Like, technically speaking, LaVine is a free agent this year, assuming he re-signs. And if he doesn't, then you're screwed anyway. But with DeRozan has another 2 years. Vooch has one more. And then if they want to retain him, they can. What that means is once DeMar DeRozan ages out of being this guy, it is going to be extremely hard for Chicago to functionally replace him in the pecking order, because they're too good, and they've already traded away some draft picks to have that kind of thing. So it would have to be the rise of an internal player, and you could make the argument, well, duh, that's supposed to be Patrick Williams, but that would be a lot offensively for him to do. And if all of a sudden it becomes LaVine as the, not the primary creator, but the kind of one and only really, really good creator on this team, it fundamentally changes their trajectory and kind of the peak of their arc is one way of putting it. And so if that's the case, if my theory is right, and maybe Coby White could get there, maybe there's some sort of internal improvement with Lonzo or Caruso that gets them to a different juncture, or LaVine just becomes even better, and at that point you don't need a second guy. But if I were playing the odds, I would say that these next 2 years are probably your best window for that structure, and you have a lot of these other guys under contract. So assuming you'd rather have two better chances and then tail off from there, that would be an argument in favor of going now.
Yeah, and I mean, even if the Bulls get improvement from all their young guys and improvement from LaVine and whatever, like improvement from Patrick Williams in the future in the next couple of years, let's say like 3 years from now, all those guys improve, you still don't have a way to get a top 10 player, right? Like you said.
Agreed.
So like, this is it. I mean, I don't know what they're waiting for. This is the only time that they can reasonably count on having one of those guys, top 10 guys, because, you know, he's already there. So this is the time where I think you, as a just general franchise building mode, like you really have to be aggressive when you get these opportunities.
Are there any other kind of bull stories that, as somebody who follows the team more closely, that you think are worth other people keeping an eye on? It sucks that they have a couple of important guys out with injuries right now, but that does provide opportunities for other players. And if the Bulls, this is a mark of their new place in life, is that now April matters more than January, February, and March, because they're going to be there in April at bare minimum.
Yeah, we just learned today that Lonzo Ball has a meniscus tear, so that's going to be a big issue. I mean, it's a huge bummer because they just got Caruso back, and I think that the combination of Caruso and Ball is way, way better than just one of those guys, just because they like completely shut down one side of the court basically when they're playing together. It's pretty amazing to watch. But I guess the biggest storyline in Chicago that's not maybe as well known nationally is just how good Io has been.
He's been great.
I saw ESPN did like a rookie power rankings, and Io's never been on there, which I find kind of absurd, but he finally got in there at number 10 in their most recent version. I think he was the number 38 pick in the draft. So, I mean, he's clearly outperformed his draft slot already. Yeah, and a lot of the stuff that people said was not going to translate from his days at Illinois, where he was this big-time star, scored a lot of points. He took, like, all the clutch shots, and he was known for making them. The thought was that he was going to have to reduce his role and just become kind of like a specialist. But he actually has had some pretty good creation juice in the league.
Better than I thought he'd have, but I hadn't watched film, so yeah.
I hadn't watched a lot of him either at Illinois. I'm just going off what draft people said and what I read about him. The Bulls had him playing point guard a lot last night, which was pretty interesting. So yeah, he was creating for other players. He's doing a good job. And then I spoke about his defense previously, but yeah, just guarding the best players in the league and doing a pretty good job. I mean, especially for a rookie, that's like kind of crazy. I think his off-ball defense, he still gets a little bit lost sometimes, but again, like totally normal for a rookie. Yeah, but I think that, you know, anytime you draft a player in the second round, it's kind of a crapshoot if they even stick in the league for a couple years. I think with Io, like he's definitely an NBA player. I think he's like very solidly on the path to being, you know, a third guard off the bench right now with upside to be even better than that. So he's been a lot of fun to watch and just like a very unexpected surprise.
For sure. And getting capable contributions from players that were second round picks or two ways or undrafted or anything like that makes such a huge difference in terms of, I brought up the term functional depth before, because no matter what, a team is going to have some sort of injury or availability challenges, especially this year. And Dosunmu, beyond just like gap filler, like he is a player for this team. And I've been so thrilled to see it with him. I pulled the stat because I'd been thinking about it, but you mentioned it. Bulls defense when Caruso and Ball are both on the floor, 105.4 cleaning the glass defensive ratings that filters out garbage time. And that is with negative opponent shooting luck. Teams are shooting about 37% on threes. That's better than you would expect. So, yeah, floater range, and there's some other potential fluky things, and they're forcing a ton of turnovers. You can attribute a lot of that to those two gentlemen, though other guys deserve credit too. And it's not only that for me. I think that's an important part of it, and I'm happy you brought it up. But because having Lonzo out means that there will be more minutes where neither Lonzo Ball nor Alex Crusoe is on the floor, and the Bulls have comparatively struggled in those minutes because they don't have as many they don't have as much defensive personnel now.
Yeah, the other guy in that situation is Javonte Green too. I don't think he gets nearly enough credit for how good he is defensively. So I think when the Bulls have two of those three guys on the floor, they're really good. When they have one of those three, they're okay. And then when they have none, which has been the case for a lot of this period where their defense has been declining, that's when they just stink. I mean, they can't stop anybody. They depend so heavily on these quick rotations and just getting in the passing lanes and getting steals. So when they don't have that, teams just kind of pick them apart.
With just Ball and Caruso off the floor, 120 defensive rating. With Ball, Caruso, and Javonte Green off the floor, 125 defensive rating.
Yeah, I hadn't looked at the numbers, but I mean, just from eye test, I figured that was probably the case.
Yeah, it's pretty striking. We have a little bit of time left. I wanted to, first of all, of course, congratulate you on the new gig at the Sporting News. I'm so thrilled.
Thank you. I've been
a fan of your work for a while. And you're doing something, I'm a little bit jealous. I'm not doing as much writing at the present moment. And it's a serious idea. And more the idea and the execution, because you do good work with video, of the way you're phrasing it is hidden gems. And so it's players that are, well, I'll let you define how you define a hidden gem.
Sure. I mean, I think that a lot of the coverage in the league is just among like the big stars, like the top 25 guys, let's say. And then the major markets like LA, Chicago, New York, what have you. So I just think that's a shame because the league is so interesting and so varied. And there's so many good stories out there. So many players that don't get on national TV, where I know you watch a ton of League Pass games. And you see these guys and you're like, wow, these guys are so fun to watch. I just wish that there was more attention brought to some of these players. So that was kind of the idea behind this column, Hidden Gems. I'm going to write it. It's going to come out every Tuesday at Sporting News. The two guys that I've had so far, Jakob Poeltl, which, you know, nobody outside of San Antonio really knows much about him, but he's awesome. I mean, he's probably, I would say he's probably the best rim protector behind Rudy Gobert. Definitely flawed offensively. Like, it's kind of an adventure when he gets to the free throw line, but just like, people need to know who Jakob Poeltl is. And then the most recent guy I had was Jared Vanderbilt,
who's
more of a role player. But yeah, I mean, like, you see his highlights and they're just awesome. And even just like watching full games of him, he really pops on the screen. The next one I'm going to do is Desmond Bane, who is a little bit more well-known, but still, I feel like the casual NBA fans have heard of Bane because he has a cool last name, but they might not really know all that his game entails. So I just want to like increase the scope of storytelling in the league. I try to make these interesting, you know, I try to have some colorful writing in there. And I'm just so sick of, you know, like reading the same Ben Simmons story or reading the same Kyrie Irving story. Like, I just want us to just focus on there's like 450 players in the league. There's way more this year, and let's talk about the whole league. I think people don't give enough credit to the fans, that the fans nowadays are so much smarter, and you can really challenge them to learn more about the league, and I think that they will enjoy that, and that's been the case so far with the first two stories I've done.
For sure, and I mean, that's been a big part of what I have intended to do, and your work is far more accessible because you do good stuff with video, which I wish I was better at, and I feel old now, so maybe I don't, but I certainly could be better at it. But the way that I like a different way of phrasing, which is that part of the beauty of basketball, and part of, I mean, I didn't grow up watching the sport. I grew up with a lot of other sports, but part of what makes it so wonderful is that both from a star perspective, but also from a role player complimentary guy perspective, there are a lot of different ways to succeed and there are a lot of different ways to fail. And some of the hidden gems around the league do a particularly good job of either covering up the shortcomings of somebody else or making something viable. And I think Vanderbilt is an amazing example of that, of like Karl-Anthony Towns sort of like we talked about with DeRozan, I don't think that he is dramatically better defensively this year, but the Wolves have been better defensively, and part of that is they put better things around him, and they're able to do some of the things on that end. Also, they're forcing an ungodly amount of turnovers, which Vanderbilt is an important part of. And so they're getting something that works in a different way than it did before, and Vanderbilt is an essential part of that.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I got to mention Ben Taylor at some point in this podcast. Sure. He had a great video. I think it was actually his video coordinator, Mike De La Rosa, that did the Wolves defense one. But also we were talking about Caruso and Ball, their defensive combination. Ben Taylor has a great video on that. So I'm sure, like, if you're listening to this podcast, you're probably familiar with his work. But if you're not, then yeah, go watch those videos. They're great.
Absolutely. And going back to Poeltl briefly, it reached, I'm hoping, its zenith during the conference finals, but there was this whole Twitter referendum, and I don't think Twitter is real life. I don't think any of that type of stuff, on the rim protecting center, and like, oh, Rudy Gobert is not the defensive player of the year because the Clippers were able to, or sorry, that wasn't the conference finals, that was the second round. Here's the thing. Very few defenses are going to work as a one-man band in the playoffs. That's just not the way things are going to happen. And there is so much that a player like Poeltl, like Gobert, can do to help a team. And not saying the Spurs need to do this. They have guys like DeJounte Murray to basically give them a foundation. An example that I used to use, because they're the team I'm closest to geographically, was Andrew Bogut used to clean up a lot of messes for the Warriors. And eventually they had fewer messes to clean up because they got better perimeter defenders and the guys they had improved internally. But there is so much that a player like that can do to help. And incidentally, like, Nate and I were riffing recently, we were doing the Southeast Division pod, and I was saying, if San Antonio is actually thinking about moving Jakob Poeltl, like, there was those murmurs about Poeltl potentially going to the Raptors, Charlotte should be all over that. Because, yeah, Poeltl might be some limitations in the playoffs and everything else like that, but he would do so much to just clean up their messes and put a floor on their defense.
Yeah, I love that idea. I haven't heard any rumors about him going there, but yeah, I heard the Raptor stuff. I mean, I think that, you know, the people that are watching a lot of the league, a ton of the league, like people that work in the league, I think they recognize his value. But yeah, to the casual fan that maybe watches, you know, one or two games a week, like, they probably have never seen Poeltl, right? So, yeah, I think there's this whole slew of guys. Like, basketball is such a beautiful game, and it's not just about getting buckets, you know? So just pointing out things that you can appreciate, I think that's what really excites me when I write. And yeah, that's kind of the genesis of this column, I guess, is finding the Poeltls throughout the league that, you know, once you see what they do, once somebody points it out, it's very easily recognizable. And then you get to enjoy that, like, every single time you watch that player.
For sure. And it also makes every team look and feel different, which I truly love. And so there are some teams that don't have those guys and are less watchable, or that are watchable for different reasons. But it is really fun. And I appreciate all of the teams that do it differently. I mean, Cleveland has been a wonderful example of that this year, and they're it's not the switchy do everything, but they're doing a great job protecting the rim. They're not fouling, but having size, it helps if you have Evan Mobley, Jared Allen, everything else. What I wanted to end on, I often do these, especially for people who keep an eye on the whole league, is we're at a weird part of the year. You know, trade deadline's a couple weeks away, still having protocol absences and unfortunately injuries. We talked about Lonzo and everything else with the Bulls, but also outside of that, what are you looking at teams, players over the next few weeks?
What am I looking at? I guess, like, I've been focusing lately on the Lakers just because of this whole Westbrook stuff. And just figuring out, I would like your opinion on this, Danny, is like, I kind of feel like, we probably don't have quite enough time for this, but I feel like Westbrook, obviously he's had, like, not a great season, right? But I felt like Vogel was really being scapegoated for a lot of the Lakers' problems, and now Westbrook is getting scapegoated. Like, yeah, they paid him a lot of money to be a big part of winning there, but I mean, the reason why they stink is, like, just the other guys, right? Like, the bottom half of their roster is just terrible. So, I mean, what do you think? Do you think that he is getting an appropriate amount of blame, or do you think that, I mean, like, I guess my point is, like, if they just completely bench him, like, the problems aren't going away, right?
The problems aren't going away, and I would throw it in a couple of different directions. So part of it is a version of bad luck where I thought the Lakers, going back in time, I thought they did a reasonably good job for minimum guys, though minimum players, it's very rare to do extremely well. Like, there's only so far you can go. You're going to get more Carmelo Anthony's, guys who can do one or two things well but can't do everything well. But, Bazemore, and I loved Malik Monk, and he's had some really nice stretches so far this year. But the overall thesis, I think, is pretty sound, and that's they didn't have enough overall quality. And I put a lot of that on the feet of Rob Pelinka, because we brought up Caruso before, but you could also, of course, tie this to Kentavious Caldwell-Pope and some of the other moves that they made, where I thought that the Lakers' general concept after they won the championship was pretty straightforward, which is LeBron and Anthony Davis, especially when he's playing the five, you build it around their pick and roll. And not only that, it's not just two offense-only players. Those guys can be important parts, especially AD. I thought he was the best defensive player in the 2020 playoffs. You can do a lot there. And so what you need around those players are ideally guys that can shoot enough the teams guard them so that they can't clog the lane and mess up those actions, and players who can at least credibly defend, so Davis doesn't have to clean up as many messes and everything else. That was what I thought. I thought it's like, this is a vindication, and they had Caruso, and they had KCP, and Danny Green, and all these other guys. And it felt to me, with the Montrezl Harrell signing, and the Westbrook trade, and everything else, that Rob Pelinka just immediately moved away from almost all of that. And you could have enough talent, those guys are good enough that it could work, but Davis has had a down year, and of course he's been unavailable now for a while. So that part of it, I do think, to me, the person who has done the most wrong here is Rob Pelinka, not Frank Vogel, not Russell Westbrook. However, the part of the Russell Westbrook story that for years now, years and years and years now, that has gone under-noticed by many, not by everyone, but by many, are his defensive limitations. And I was interested that Dave McMenamin's piece, which came out after the loss to the Pacers and Vogel didn't play Westbrook during the last 4 minutes, talked about how he wasn't executing the scouting report against Caris LeVert. And Westbrook freelances a lot. He freelances in situations where it makes no sense. He goes for, his defensive rebounding is actually valuable because he can push the ball in transition and everything else. But when he skips out on his own assignment, and so there is no defensive rebound because the ball goes through the basket, it becomes a problem. And so I don't think that Russell Westbrook is the reason why the Lakers were, last year, they were second in defense, and this year they're 21st. That you do not lay all of that on the feet of one man, especially not Russell Westbrook. But his contributions to their fragility on that end, I think, are important.
I think all that's fair. I think the other big thing about the whole Pelinka stuff is, and maybe this isn't fair, but because COVID has been so unpredictable, but I think the teams that have done really well this year have been the ones that have been deep. Like, sure. I think that's why the Grizzlies are such a surprise story, because, for years now, they've just had like a million solid rotation players, right? And there have been teams like this in regular seasons in the past. Like, I think it back to those Hawks teams of the mid-2010s, and then Brad Stevens Celtics teams, where they don't have a lot of top-end talent, but they're just so, so deep that they rack up regular season wins. So I don't know. I feel like you kind of had to expect that roster depth was going to be at a premium this year, and the Lakers just zagged when, I thought that was kind of obvious. I just think that's another reason why, Pelinka really deserves a ton of blame here, basically.
Well, and there's this idea. I was consulting with Bill Oram, because I do that CBA stuff for The Athletic, about he was trying to figure out how to phrase some stuff when when Caruso played the Lakers the first time, and the decision that the Lakers made. And it was, we're talking about like money, and it's like, they chose, you could phrase it in a bunch of different ways. It's like you could say they chose saving money over keeping Alex Caruso because they have full bird rights and they could have done it. You could also argue that they chose Kendrick Nunn over Alex Caruso because he got paid $5 million. That's not that much less than Caruso, and you'd have to pay the luxury tax on the difference and all that type of stuff. Or THT, you could say in certain arguments. But the point that I tried to make, and it was harder to, I can't remember how much Bill included in the piece, was in many ways the real choice they made was Russell Westbrook, because if the Lakers had a hard line in terms of how much they're willing to spend. And if, you know, I criticize owners all the time for having a hard line and having it being too low. And you have LeBron James, you have one of the best players on the planet, and he's, you know, you don't know how many years. We talked about how DeRozan might not have many years left. LeBron is a cyborg sent from the future to run basketball, but he also still might not have that much time left as this level of player. And so you, so, but let's say you have to take that as a given. Okay, that you have this hard line. Pelinka did an extremely poor job to me managing that, because Russell Westbrook, you know, so if you have that money to spend, you could, you know, you could do that in KCP or Harrell or and Harrell, and maybe you can do something different with the mid-level. You could keep Alex Crusoe. You could get guys. You don't have to use more than half of your roster spots on minimum players who are always going to have limitations. And that is the other part of putting all the eggs in one basket. I talked a lot about how you can't, it's hard to make a follow-up trade. You know, like, you can't, once you get Russell Westbrook, unless he maximizes his value, you're kind of in your Russell Westbrook team now. And that is a real challenge. He has this huge player option for next year. So it's all of those things at the same time that if they had, if they said, okay, $18 million above the tax with the payment and everything like that, or maybe it's $20 million, whatever it is, we're not going over that. Assuming Jeannie Buss and the Busses told Pelinka that before the start of the offseason, if they didn't, that's malpractice. Then this was a very poor job building within that constraint.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. I think everybody's attention is just on the Lakers. Like, I know I was speaking previously about how I'm trying to focus on the smaller market teams, but it's just
but they're a fascinating situation. I mean, to see a team, I mean, that's, to me, is the weirdest part of the Lakers story now, is that in the early stretch of the season, it was like, the Lakers are struggling, what's wrong? And my basic take was, their best players aren't playing that well. Like, LeBron struggled to start the year. He also, I believe, if memory serves, missed some time. Anthony Davis was having one of the worst years of his career. And we're like, okay, if those guys start playing better, this is going to be better. LeBron has been roughly awesome for the last month plus, and they're still not beating teams. So it's kind of like, the overall story is similar, but it's a more concerning part of the story that now there are fewer levers to pull. And it's like, what are you going to do there? And because LeBron is like, it feels different to have one of the best players in the league playing well and having his team still lose. Like, that is a fundamentally different thing than I think we're used to, especially with LeBron, who one of the most amazing parts of his trajectory is raising the floor of flawed teams.
Yeah, I think you're totally spot on there.
So, I mean, it's been a while, but he had to do that for long portions in the early portion of his career for a lot of teams.
Yeah, and, you know, he's obviously adapting his game a lot too, you know, playing more at the five now, being pretty successful with that, and it's still not enough to really get the Lakers over the hump. So yeah. I think everybody's just keeping an eye on the Lakers these days.
And who knows, maybe I hope to be wrong with this, but maybe we're obsessing about them now because we're not going to be thinking about them as much in March and April.
Yeah, we'll have to wait and see. Yeah. I know it's interesting that, like, a lot of these models too were really, really low on the Lakers. And I think people, myself included, were skeptical on why the models hated them so much. Turns out that at least on that one they were right.
It might be results instead of process. It's kind of hard. I don't have an eye into some of those black boxes, but yeah, I mean, it looks like they're gonna be closer to the pin than I was. I picked their over on the over under, and at least 538's model was there. I'll mention one other thing in terms of teams that I'm watching. Now that Miami's close to hole, I'm gonna be very interested in watching them, because they're the other kind of elephant in the room for the Eastern Conference conversation, because I've still been skeptical of their half court offense, but they can be really dangerous. So I'm excited to see them at close to full strength.
Yeah, the top of the East race is wide, wide open. I mean, there's very little more. I haven't checked the standings super recently, but there's only a couple games separating, like, all of those teams. So anybody could come out.
Anyone
first.
Could come out, and I'm sure seeding is going to matter a lot, and I have no idea how just yet.
Yeah, if you can avoid playing Milwaukee and Brooklyn, I mean, that's a huge win, right? So
absolutely,
there's probably going to be a little bit of strategic wins and losses towards the end of the year.
For sure. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me, Danny. It's always a pleasure.
Thanks again to Stefan Noh for taking the time to come on. You can read his excellent work at The Sporting News, and you can also follow him on Twitter at Steph Noh, STEPHNOH. love having him on, and we've known each other for years, and I believe this is the first time he's ever done Real GM Radio, which is my fault, not his, of course, and really enjoyed the conversation and getting a sense of what's working for the Chicago Bulls. Apologies again for the delay for this episode. It was a publishing thing as Real GM Radio transitioned to CLNS, which I'm super duper excited about, but that's why things got pushed around a little bit. If you want to support the show, there are a lot of different things you can do. You can leave a rating, leave a review in the podcast player of your choosing. Makes a huge difference. Helps other people find the show. Word of mouth is also there. But the biggest thing is subscribing, downloading every episode, because that helps our numbers, that helps advertisers and everything else. So really do appreciate that. You can also check out my other work, Dunked On and Dunked On Prime. We just did the mock-up trade deadline. I was going to say mock-off season. That's a different time. Really fun with Nate and Kevin Pelton and Dan Feldman. And I believe the first part of that is public, but then the rest is for Prime subscribers. We're also doing a sale right now. You can also check out my written work at The Athletic. Have a couple of things coming out in the very near future, including a trade deadline big board, which is a collaborative piece with Seth Partnow and Sam Vecenie, and then another piece of my own on the trade deadline. And I did a collaborative piece with Kelly Eco on the Rockets specifically. So you have all that. And then the NBA strategy stream, newly renamed, but same awesome content. Nate and I calling a live game. That is every Monday, and we'll be doing Wizards Heat this coming Monday, 7 Eastern, 4 Pacific, if you want to join us for that. If you have any feedback on the show, good, bad, or indifferent, DannyLarueNBA@gmail.com is the way to get it to me. If you take the time to write it, I will take the time to read it. That is a promise. Replying, I try. That is not the promise, but I read everything. It's something I do every day. I have a habit of doing that. So thank you so much for listening. Take care and make it a great day.